The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests, and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. In the maple-covered hills of Vermont stands a granite monument commemorating the birthplace of the prophet Joseph Smith. It was here on a wintry New England day that the Smith family welcomed another son into the world. Of his own birth, the prophet wrote simply, "I was born in the town of Sharon, in the state of Vermont, on the 23rd day of December, A.D. 1805, to goodly parents." With us in studio today is Gary Boatwright, Jr. Gary has worked for the Church History Department since the year 2000. His current assignment is Historic Sites Researcher, where he is involved in writing historic site guides for the missionaries that work at these sites. Gary received a bachelor's degree in history and geography from Weber State University and a master's degree in museum studies from the University of Oklahoma. As mentioned, Gary has most recently written the site guide for the Joseph Smith Jr. birthplace in Sharon, Vermont. And we welcome you, Gary.
Thank you.
Tell us just briefly about the site in Sharon.
Oh, well, the site in Sharon, the only way I can really describe it is it's a beautiful, sacred site. It's neatly tucked away in the hills of Vermont between the towns of Sharon and South Royalton. And it's just a peaceful, spiritual place that I've learned to love over the last few years as I've been working on some projects associated with it.
What buildings or monuments are actually there?
Well, there's the Joseph Smith Monument, of course, which is the granite monument that everybody knows or recognizes from the Joseph Smith birthplace. There's also a visitor center there, which is a small building that houses some exhibits about the prophet and his family and his early life in Vermont, and also his contributions as a prophet throughout his whole life. And then we have some archaeological remains at the site. We have the remains of the foundation of the Solomon Matcomb and also of the Daniel Matcomb. And then there's some historic features of a rock wall and an old Sharon Road, which used to be the main road connecting Royalton and Sharon that was frequented by the Smiths and the Macs. And then just a beautiful landscape. You know, you can climb to the top of Patriarch Hill and get a wonderful view of the Green Mountains and of the monument, and just a lovely, lovely place.
Let's talk a little bit about the families and their circumstances that eventually brought the prophet Joseph into the world. Tell us about his grandparents and his parents, if you would.
Well, let's probably first talk about Solomon Mack. I've learned to love Solomon Mack quite a bit. He had a very interesting life. He was born on September 15th, 1732 in Lyme, Connecticut. And his family, they were doing quite well, but there was an economic depression early in his life. And his parents had to bound him out as an indentured servant. And so he was bound out until he was 21 years old.
So describe briefly what that means to be an indentured servant.
Well, basically, he was contracted to be a full-time employee of whoever he was contracted to. It was, you know, he was asked to do anything and everything, and he had to work, basically. He couldn't leave or until he had fulfilled his obligation.
And his family got some remuneration because of this? Or?
They did. We don't know exactly what that is. Solomon, in his autobiography, simply states that he was bound out by his parents. And he faithfully, but somewhat grudgingly, I think, did that. And he even writes of a time, about the time when he was probably in his late teens, early 20s, where he said that there was a dispute with him, and as he referred to him as his master. And he left, Solomon left, but he felt that he needed to fulfill the obligation that really his parents had made. And so he went back and fulfilled his indenture. And following his service there, he began a lifelong pursuit of financial prosperity, which unfortunately he never really did quite realize in his life. So, but, you know, he, as he left his indenture, he did almost everything and anything that you could do in New England at the time. He was a farmer, he was a sailor, he was a soldier. He enlisted 3 times to serve in the French and Indian War, and he was, in fact, in the battle at Fort Ticonderoga, which is one of the most famous battles of that war, and he escaped, you know, that battle without dying, which was miraculous because he writes that he had a bullet fly underneath his chin, just mere inches from his head. But he went on, like I said, to do sailing, and you know, he, in the Revolutionary War, he helped produce saltpeter, which was essential in making gunpowder, which the colonial forces so desperately needed during the Revolution. But the sad part about this is all these activities took him away from his family. And he was frequently gone from his family, often for years at a time. And there's a period where he and his son had purchased a boat where he was gone for 4 years from his family. And he returned home to find that they were destitute. They had been kicked out of their home and were just poor. And this is just kind of a lifelong struggle that we see in Solomon's life. And he readily acknowledges it in his autobiography that, looking back on it, it was a mistake because he was searching after these riches, but he wasn't searching for God in his life. And Solomon's wife, Lydia Gates, she was really the strong point of the family. She's the one who cared for the children. And, you know, when Solomon was away so frequently, she raised the children. And Solomon even states in his autobiography that, you know, she's the perfect instructress to teach children. She grew up in a religious home, and she passed on those traits to her children. Of course, you know, Lucy Mack was one of them. And so, you know, the influence of Lucy's mother in her life, her religious feelings and, you know, her God-fearing nature really, you know, was passed through Lucy Mack Smith and then, of course, onto the prophet Joseph. But Solomon Mack, later in his life, he kind of realized the folly of his ways and had some experiences which brought him closer to God, and he devoted the rest of his life to serving God and helping others to come unto Christ. And that was, you know, part of the reason why he wrote an autobiography around 1811. He sold his farm, we believe, to help pay to publish this book. And he went around and distributed his autobiography to help others come unto Christ as he had come.
Thinking about publishing something like an autobiography or a religious experience pamphlet, was that a common thing in the day, or?
You know, I'm not really positive on that. I haven't really done a lot of whole research on that, but we know that during this time, shortly before this time, you know, religion was a big thing in New England and the colonies, and we know about the the Great Awakening that occurred in that area. And there's a lot of religious figures in that area. And religion really was a part of everybody's life. I mean, it was interesting that, you know, Solomon really wasn't caught up in religion. And he blamed a lot of that on his master when he was an indentured servant. He states that he wasn't taught about God or anybody by his master. And so I don't think he was especially unique, but the surrounding, his environment and the religion that was around in New England and such a component of everybody's life, you know, it influenced him. And especially having his wife Lydia, who was a religious person, who strongly believed in God and taught her children to pray, undoubtedly that played a big influence in Solomon's later conversion and dedication to God for the rest of his life.
So let's move to the other side of the family for a minute.
Okay. Azel Smith, of course, Joseph's grandfather, he was born in Topsfield, Massachusetts on March 7th in 1744. And Topsfield, Massachusetts was really you could call it the Smith home base. From the first Smiths who arrived in the New World, they settled in Topsfield and grew up and got married and, you know, his kids would just stay there, you know, for generations. Well, Azel, he, not being the oldest, he basically had to fend for himself when he came of age. It was tradition at the time that the oldest son in the family received the land of the parent. And so Azel had most likely been taught how to be a cooper and other skills from his father. And so he went out and began to work. And as he grew and eventually married Mary Duty, they began their family. And they were still living in Topsfield for quite some time. In fact, Joseph Smith Sr. Was born in his grandfather's home in Topsfield. But as time went on, we know that Azel, like Solomon Mack, enlisted as a soldier in the Revolutionary War. And then, you know, approximately 20 years later in 1791, as his children are a little more grown, he decides to make a new beginning for himself in Vermont. So he and his oldest son travel to Vermont. They find some acreage of land in Tunbridge, Vermont. It's virgin forest, and he purchases the land. He goes back to get his family in Massachusetts. And then Joseph Sr. and Jesse Smith, his older brother, began to clear this land, and they built a log home in preparation for the family. And Azel eventually moved his family up to Tunbridge, Vermont. And, of course, we know it's there in Tunbridge that Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack met each other. But speaking of his grandparents, Joseph Smith, his grandparents really played an important role in his life, and they really influenced the feelings that he would have later in life. And there's speaking of liberty, Joseph Smith, he said that it is a love of liberty which inspires my soul, civil and religious liberty, to the whole of the human race. And then he continues, love of liberty was diffused into my soul by my grandfathers while they dandled me on their knees. And so Joseph, he had close interaction with his grandparents. And, you know, we know that later in his life that Azel Smith, you know, believed in the prophet's calling. And in fact, Joseph later stated that Azel Smith, his grandfather, had predicted that the Lord would raise up a prophet in his family, and that Azel believed that Joseph Smith Jr. was the fulfillment of that prediction. So The Smith family and the Mack family, really, their lives, their experiences, their traditions, and their faith really played a role in the lives of Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack, who raised their family in a God-fearing and loving home where they were taught to read the scriptures and pray and believe in God. And subsequently, this is the type of environment that the prophet grew up in. And so really, his grandparents and even his great-grandparents and all the way back, they really played an influence in preparing the way and preparing an environment for the prophet to grow up in and to be prepared to receive his call as a prophet.
You might also think that the hardships that his parents and grandparents went through also prepared him for some of the hardships that would come in his life.
Well, you're right. Solomon Mack and Azel Smith and even the prophet's parents, you know, they struggled through life. You know, the Smith family, when they moved up to Tunbridge, you know, they didn't have the convenience of just moving into a home and settling right down. There was a lot of hard work and dedication that went into it, and a lot of sacrifice and trials as well. And even, you know, with Solomon Mack, during his many excursions, you know, he frequently faced obstacles. I mean, he was shipwrecked once and fighting in, you know, battles in the French and Indian War. I mean, all these trials and tribulations, as we know, as in our own lives, as they help strengthen us, they strengthen these, the Macks and the Smiths. And when shortly after Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack were married, they faced their own trials. You know, they were raising their children, and Joseph, he was given a farm to live on in Tunbridge, and he decided he was going to try his hand at storekeeping in nearby Randolph, Vermont. And so he bought a number of items on credit from a Boston merchant, and he went into debt for it. Well, he also at this time tried his hand at selling crystallizing ginseng. And we know about the famous story where he crystallized the ginseng and was preparing to ship it to China in hopes of making a large profit. And he was asked by one of the merchants to serve as a middleman. And, you know, he said, if you give me your ginseng, I can, you know, make sure it gets to China and bring back the funds. But Joseph believed that he could make more profit if he took the middleman out and did it himself. Well, when the ship came back from China, all he was told he received was a chest of tea. And so his hopes of financial prosperity were ruined. And so, you know, the family had a struggle. How are they going to maintain their income and their standard of living? I mean, because they had owed this money to the Boston merchants, which Joseph was hoping to use some of this money to pay them back. And, you know, we know that Lucy Mack, she was given a gift of $1,000 from her brother and her brother's business partner. Well, they used that to help settle some of the debt, but then the Smiths had to sell their farm in Tunbridge, and that began a series of moves that the Smiths experienced while in New England, and that's part of which of what led to the Smiths renting a home on Solomon Mack's farm in Sharon, Vermont. But, you know, their moves and their struggles continued until, you know, they finally moved to Palmyra in 1816, where they actually had a little bit of stability in their life. They were able to purchase some land and, as we know, build a nice log home and eventually a frame home. You know, so for a few years they had some stability in their lives, but it kind of started all over again in Palmyra years later.
So the prophet Joseph, having been close to his grandparents and knowing all these stories, it just seems that's part of the reason why he kind of took hardships and persecution in stride, good-naturedly.
I believe so. You know, being around his grandparents and his parents, and as you said, knowing what they had gone through and seeing, you know, what fine men and women they were, you know, I think the prophet, you know, knew inside that, you know, these things, you know, are bad and, you know, they're tough to get through, but I'm going to be better because of it. And in Liberty Jail, in the lowest portion of his life, you know, the Lord confirmed that to him, that all these things shall be for thy good. And so I think that's, you know, really right what you're saying, that he kind of took him in stride. I mean, he, like the rest of us, he didn't want to go through them, but he had that eternal perspective and the experience of his family, knowing that, you know, this is going to make me a better person, if to go through these trials and to come out on the other end having endured them.
Thank you. Let's move to the Sharon, Vermont site again.
Okay.
Tell me how it came about, who was instrumental in making the monument and getting the property.
Okay. Well, Junius F. Wells, he is really was the driver behind the Joseph Smith Monument. And he visited the site in 1894, if I have my dates correctly. Yeah, 1894. He traveled to Vermont, and while he was there, he inquired in the local records office of where is the land that the prophet Joseph was born on. Well, he was directed to a local resident named Harvey Smith, who's no relation to Joseph. And Harvey Smith took him up to the top of this hill called Derry Hill and showed him the ruins of the home where it was believed that the prophet Joseph was born. Well, during this trip, Junius thought, you know, well, wouldn't it be ideal to mark this spot as the birthplace of the prophet Joseph? Well, you know, that idea kind of just, he put in his back pocket and kind of remained dormant for a decade. Well, in 1905, which was the 100th anniversary of the birth of the prophet, Junius Wells revived this idea of marking the site of the prophet's birth. And I believe that he felt that, you know, this was a perfect timing and a perfect way to honor the prophet for his 100th birthday. So Junius F. Wells, he met with the First Presidency, Joseph F. Smith was president of the church at the time, discussed the idea with them, and they gave him the go-ahead to go back to Vermont, research the site and confirm that it was indeed the birthplace of the prophet, and to purchase the site. So that's exactly what Junius did. And he spent a few months gathering information and affidavits and meeting with longtime residents of the area, who all confirmed that the spot he was shown nearly 10 years ago was indeed the spot of the home where the prophet Joseph was born. Well, Junius Wells, he was also, during this time, he was also looking to erect a monument in honor of his father, Daniel Wells, for the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And he was meeting with some folks from R.C. Bowers and Company that were out of Montpelier, Vermont, about erecting this monument for his father. But during the conversation, he also brought up the idea of a monument for the prophet. And these people he was meeting with, they, you know, said that would be a feasible idea. We could easily do that. And so Junius drew up some plans and designs of the monument, sent them back to Joseph F. Smith and the First Presidency, and they approved the project. And this was in July of 1905 when they actually approved the project. And it was on July 24th 1905 that he signed the contract with the company to create the project. And I emphasize that because this was a tremendous undertaking. You know, they signed the contract in near the end of July 1905. Well, the plan was to have the monument erected and dedicated on December 23rd, 1905, just a few short months away. But Junius F. Wells, being the person and dedicated person that he was, he moved right ahead. They found out that the best stone that they could build the monument out of was in Barrie, Vermont, just a short ways from the birthplace. And as they were searching through the quarry for these perfect pieces of granite to build a monument from, Junius F. Wells, he wanted to have the perfect piece of stone from which the main section of the sculpture would be made from. And this was the long shaft that we know that is 38 and a half feet long, with each foot representing a year of the prophet's life. And speaking of this, Junius F. Wells stated that, "I was after a perfect shaft, a stone that was large enough to measure when it should be polished up, 4 feet at the base, and long enough to measure 38 and a half feet, a foot for each year of the prophet's life." Well, finding a stone that large is extremely difficult, and especially to have it that large and transport it without it cracking or even breaking. But they were able to, after a thorough search of the quarry, they were able to find a block of granite from which this could be made. So they got the stones cut out of the mountain. They shipped them off to the polisher who polished them. And there's 5 stones total, which amounted to almost 100 tons of total weight. And now you have to remember, this is 1905. You know, they're still doing things with horses and wagons. And the majority of the trip, they were able to load up on the railroad, which saved tremendous amount of times and eased the process. But when the stones were unloaded in Royalton, Vermont, there were still a number of miles that they had to be pulled up to the birthplace. And I emphasize up. I mean, it's an uphill road. And even today, if you go to the Joseph Smith birthplace, when you leave the main road and begin the drive up Derry Hill Road, if you have a small car, I mean, it struggles going up the hill. And so this really was a tremendous undertaking that Junius F. Wells was commencing on. And so they, in order to do this, they had a special wagon made. The wagon itself weighed 2 tons, and they were drawn by a number of horses. And one of the things that they had to do in Royalton was to cross the White River. And there was a newly constructed steel bridge, but it wasn't strong enough to hold this load. And so there was an old wooden bridge downstream that they shored up and, you know, put more supports in so they could get the load across the river. But that was kind of the easy part compared to what they had ahead of them. But as they began pulling these stones up, and they did them one at a time, it took days to take them from Royalton and to get them to the birthplace. And along the way, they would have to use block and tackle, which basically they would, you know, tie ropes to the trees along the road, and using a pulley system, they would help the horses and pull this up the hill just ever so slowly. And, you know, but while they were doing this, and as the local residents, you know, kind of caught wind and heard what was going on, they were all saying, you know, you're never going to make it. You know, there's no way you can get this done. You know, this is Vermont. You know, winters are quite harsh here. And in fact, they said that, you know, from early November to the end of March, there's snow on the ground, you know, which is just going to make it that much more difficult. Well, Junius Wells, he, you know, just kind of kept reminding himself, this is, you know, we're doing this for the Lord's profit. And, you know, he prayed and had faith that they would be able to meet the deadline. And so the weather, for the most part, throughout this whole process, was actually quite nice for Vermont, and especially as it got into the winter months. But there was one day that they really thought, you know, they were going to struggle, and that, you know, it might bring a whole thing to the stop. And in fact, I just want to read here from what Junius Wells wrote regarding this day and the situation that they faced. He says that we Latter-day Saints are believers in Providence, not only believers in what Mr. Boutwell, and this was a local resident he was referring to, but in what Mr. Boutwell calls Mormon luck, but in Providence. Even in the matter of weather, we feel so. The day before, we had across Mr. Button's mud hole, and this along the road, this is kind of a flat area of the road and kind of a little low-lying, so it's a place where water would gather and would be really marshy. But the day before they had to cross Mr. Button's mud hole, it rained. There was an empty hay press that tried to go through it, and the wheels went out of sight. It took four horses to get it out. Next, it commenced to snow, but the thermometer dropped in 3.5 hours, 35 degrees, and the north wind blew the storm down to sea. We had arranged to have 9-inch thickness of planks at that mud hole if necessary to get over. As it happened, we only needed 3, for when the wagons went over it the next morning, the ground was frozen so hard that it split the planks into kindling wood, and the weather has not been so cold since. I called that Providence. So really, during the as they moved these stones and erected it, Junius Wells, he saw the hand of God in assisting him to get this completed. And during the dedication of the monument, President Joseph F. Smith, he stated, and I quote, "When I pass over the roads over which he, Junius Wells, has brought these immense blocks of granite successfully and erected them on this spot where they are destined to remain by providence of God, it is something marvelous in my eyes. I am astonished at it." And so really, this was, I believe, a miraculous feat to do in such a short period of time, and to have it done on time. And in fact, the monument, it was completed on December 8th, a few days, you know, before the dedication. And, you know, the dedication and the faithfulness of Junius Wells to get this project completed just amazes me. I mean, it's an example to me of really, once you determine to do something and you've been asked by the Lord's prophet to do something, you do it. And, you know, as you do that, the Lord will bless you and assist you.
Does it seem fitting to you that, based on the struggles that Joseph's ancestors had to go through and Joseph himself, that the whole process of getting the monument up to the top of Derry Hill Road was also a struggle, was a hardship? It just seems rather fitting or ironic. I'm not sure.
You know, I've never thought of it that way, but that is, you know, that is so true. I mean, the fact that, you know, the prophet, you know, faced so many trials and adversity in his life. You know, it, like I said, it only seems fitting that Junius Wells, in erecting this monument, had to go through some struggles himself. And it's, I guess you could, you know, say it's kind of symbolic of the prophet's life, you know, not just how tall it is, but how it was erected. You know, it had to go through, you know, it had to be cut out of the mountain and shaped and polished, hauled up a large hill and finally erected to where, It has stood now for over 100 years and hopefully will stand for 100 more.
So how does one get to Sharon, Vermont, if someone's on vacation?
Okay. Well, Sharon, Vermont is really out of the way. And if you're flying into Vermont, the best place is to fly into Burlington, Vermont, which is on the western side of that. And the main freeway, I believe it's I-89. I usually have my GPS thing, so I just follow it. But you follow the main highway from Burlington southeast. And, you know, as you're driving, you'll start seeing signs for towns that we hear about in church history, Royalton and, you know, South Royalton and Tunbridge and eventually Sharon. But you can get off at either the Royalton or the Sherrington exits and then just follow the signs. Follow the signs. If you're getting off at Royalton, follow the signs to Sharon. If you get off at Sharon, follow the signs to Royalton. And there's a road that follows the White River. Beautiful road, scenic road. I mean, it's well worth that alone. But as you go through these little villages, you'll eventually see the sign for Derry Hill Road and a marker pointing the way to the Joseph Smith birthplace. And it's a short drive now. I mean, for Junius Wells, it wasn't a short drive, but just go up Derry Hill Road and you'll find yourself in an out-of-the-way, beautiful, scenic area of the Green Mountains of Vermont.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, based on what you've done with your site information for the tour guides and missionaries and all that you've worked with this site, what are some of your final thoughts?
You know, I love the Joseph Smith birthplace, and a part of that comes obviously from the amount of time and effort I've been putting into the projects, but it is truly a special and sacred place. And oftentimes when, you know, people travel on church history trips, they start in Palmyra, and Sharon is kind of left out as, you know, because outside from the prophet being born there, you know, there were no visions or revelations or doctrinal contributions that came out of Sharon. But the thing is, the prophet came out of Sharon, and his grandparents were there, and their faith, their dedication to hard work, all these things from his grandparents and his parents helped to shape the prophet into who he was. And so I would highly recommend, if anybody is in the area, or even if they're planning a church history trip, don't exclude Sharon. You know, go and feel the spirit that is there, and talk to the missionaries and see the sights and stand in awe of the monument. And really, when you drive up Derry Hill Road and you pull up onto the birthplace and you see that monument on top of the hill, you gain an appreciation of what Junius F. Wells did, and, you know, the dedication and sacrifice he made. And as well, that monument today stands as a witness, you know, for all the Latter-day Saints, that we testify that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God and that he restored the fullness of the gospel to this earth. And so it's just a beautiful, special, and even a sacred place, I would say.
We've been visiting today with Gary Boatwright, Jr., Historic Sites Researcher for the Church History Department.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Legacy. I'm Nathan Wright.